Welcome to Rule Breakers for Gender Equality. My name is Nancy Polian, and I'm on a mission to make the top of the business world more diverse and inclusive. Because to me, rule breaking is all about taking a risk. The risk to be yourself and to create your own career path. In 2021, there were more CEOs named Peter than women CEOs in the Netherlands. This is one of the rules that I want to break. Let's see which business leader is breaking the rules today. I'm extremely happy to sit here with Manjana Smit from PVH, the most fashionable building in Amsterdam. When you walk into this office, you're just like, oh my God, I'm underdressed.
I thought you were going to say the most fashionable lady in Amsterdam, but
that too.
I guess I don't earn that. No, I don't earn that.
No, that too. Definitely. It's a beautiful building and you were just showing me your relaxed room and all of the stuff that you're doing to kind of, you know, make employees feel like they belong. It's a beautiful building.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about that more later on. But first, I have to introduce you because Manjana and myself have known each other for, I think,
dare we say,
30 years maybe.
Yeah.
But after our studies, didn't see each other. Then last year in 2022, you joined the mentorship program of Branded You at the Rijksmuseum. And we reacquainted. So that's kind of funny how things work because we did the same study. But Manjana, tell me, tell the audience about yourself, like where you're from, because I'm Surinamese and we always ask the question, who's your father, who's your mother? So where are you from?
So I was born and raised in the south of the Netherlands, in
Limburg?
A tiny village in Limburg. I even spoke dialect with my parents. The village is called Melik, and I had an amazing youth, like typical what you think of being part of a loving family. There's, you know, never any worry as a child. There is enough money to go on vacation, those types of things.
You think you were a little bit privileged?
Totally, totally privileged. Of course, I didn't know that at the time.
No, you weren't aware of it.
But exactly, which is the great thing about children, right? But I really had an amazing youth, and my grandparents had a lot of land. They are farmers, but asparagus farmers, so also known as the white gold. What was great about it as a child is that we played with my nieces and with my cousins, I should say, at the land. We built huts and things like that. So it was really an outdoors childhood.
And you were an only child.
And I'm an only child, yes. I never felt like that, actually, which is really interesting because often you also hear that when you're an only child, you're spoiled, things like that. And of course, this is my version, so maybe other people would say that, but I really don't think that my parents spoiled me. I had a very great childhood, as I said, but I don't think I got everything that I wanted, for instance. And my parents really taught me the worth of money, things like that. And I always had a lot of friends. I'm an extrovert. I'm a big extrovert. So, we always had friends, you know, boys, girls over. We had a dog. In that way, maybe I was spoiled. My parents let we do a lot of things. They were always welcoming other people in the house. So, I don't think
that
of
made
myself.
You maybe easy, you know, that made it easy for you to connect with others. That's probably why you had so many friends. But tell me about how you got to Amsterdam, because that's where we met.
Yes. So even though when I look back at my youth, I love it. When I got older and when I did my A-levels, my Ateneum, I did not know how fast to get away from there because by then it started to feel really small. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, there is this big world out there that I want to see, that I want to explore. And this tiny village is not the only thing in my life. And both my parents actually were very much it sounds a bit bad when I say it in English, village people, but they are community people. Maybe yeah. I should use that word. So it was very much always focused around the community. And I thought, but I want to go out there. So
and
anyway.
There's another thing that comes with that. Like the community always looks at you. You're yes. being watched.
Totally.
And maybe you wanted some of that anonymity that you have when you're living in a city.
Definitely.
Nobody watches you.
Definitely.
You feel more free, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think especially because my parents were such community people. My dad was Prince Carnival. so, you know, everybody, it felt that everybody knew us and was looking at us. Anyway, so I wanted to break free of that. So when I signed up for different universities in the Netherlands, basically the main concern I had was that it had to be as far away as possible from Melick. So I signed up for Groningen, which at that time would take me 5 hours to get there by public transportation. I also signed up for Leiden because I wanted to study law.
And you did, right?
And I did. I started with law. I started going to Leiden, actually, which was a good one because at that time, I think also for law, Leiden was the number one
university. And actually, it's also the most privileged start that you could have if you studied law in Leiden, because there's a lot of, even till this day, law firms that won't hire people that weren't from certain law schools in Leiden, right?
Totally. And I think it gets even worse because I became a member of a students' union. This is a real typical Dutch thing, I think. And at that time, you have Het Koor, the corps.
Yeah.
And you had another students' union called Quintus, and it was like a split off of the core, but very, very similar culture. And I became a member of that students' union. And
The latter one.
So when you talk about people or companies not hiring people with a degree other than Leiden, I think they would also, I don't know if it's still the case, but probably it is, at least somewhere, that if you have been a member of
a student union,
then you would get...
Yeah, because your friends were from there and they might be in certain positions and be able to give you a certain role.
Yeah.
That's another privileged thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing if you know this and if you have the possibility to join, right? Yeah. But a lot of people don't. And then that is where it becomes really complicated. Anyway, so I'm in Leiden. And besides being an extrovert and having a big social circle, I also like many, many different things. I have a very broad scheme of interests. So I did law and I realized I really don't like it because the only thing I knew at that time or the reason why I started studying law is that I wanted to travel the world carrying my little briefcase and travel in a plane with businessmen. And I don't know why these businessmen were there, but I just saw myself as this one woman, you know, in a plane full of men.
Maybe it's like a Hollywood movie that you saw or something.
I have no idea. We have to look that up. So anyway, that is what I knew. And I thought, okay, I'll go do international law, which I did. And it was super, super boring. I mean, why did I even think of wanting to do that? Because it's so not who I am as a person and my character.
And especially now with you working as a woman in tech.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, but then it got worse because then we still could kind of study paid by the government forever.
Yeah.
So after 2 years, I did have to do something because that was a regulation that within 2 years you had to get your first
diploma, your bachelor, kind of, something like that. Yeah,
and which I didn't. So I thought, okay, I just have to pick another studies then. And I was chatting with some friends, and one of my friends did public administration. So I thought, and she was really enthusiastic. So I decided to go study public administration, which is even more boring. But it was a perfect fit for her because she's in politics now and she's amazing and she's an ombudsman. And
okay,
you know,
so now you've got three studies down that you haven't finished.
Oh my gosh. So, okay. So then I thought, before I make my next mistake, which, you know, it's not necessarily bad, right?
No, but I love that you're sharing this story because women probably already think they have to make these great, perfect decisions.
Yeah.
So I love that you're sharing, you know, your road, your path to success, because it's not that easy.
And it's really interesting that you say that, because I also share this story here with my colleagues and with my team. And that is exactly what they say. They're so happy
to hear that.
To hear that, because they think, oh my gosh, you know, so you don't have to have the perfect career or whatever. So anyway, I did not pick another studies. What I did instead was I started working for a year. And at the same time, really do research. So what does fit with my character? What will still take me to that plane with my briefcase, you know, full of men?
But what really amazes me about this story is that you never once mentioned your parents. Like, a lot of people would be like, oh my God, my parents would have killed me after the second study that I didn't finish. That's kind of a privileged situation to be as well. Coming from a minority background, you had to deliver.
Yeah.
You had to deliver because studying is expensive and people are counting on you and they want you to succeed. So there's more pressure. Yeah. You didn't feel that pressure from your parents at all.
That's not
a privileged position to feel.
Yeah.
Or to be in, I mean.
So at some point I did have a conversation with my dad because we did have to talk about finances. And of course I was super nervous, but I also knew in my heart that both of them supported me. So you're absolutely right. And I never really thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. What I'm also thinking of is that I actually had a conversation with a very good friend of mine in the US. She is American. And I think everybody knows that when you go to university in the States,
it's more expensive.
It's really, really expensive.
You couldn't have done it there.
So she has a debt of, I don't know her. So let's say she studied 4 years, was a good university, which is probably $40,000. So, you know, 160,000 is the debt what you start with. And her background is Italian. She loves Italy. And I had a conversation with her and I said, so why don't you just go to Italy, you know, or quit your job and go there for a year or take a sabbatical or whatever. And she said, and she's white. And she said, I could never, ever do that to my parents. And I thought that was such an interesting answer. I said, why, you know.
You didn't have the sort of baggage of having to perform better than your parents did. They never gave that to you. That's a privileged position. I think a lot
of
Zoomers
and
millennials have that same position now where the parents have already done well. So they're not giving this added pressure on you to become a better version of them or to do better or to have a better life or whatever.
And that was exactly also her point, what she was struggling with. And I never had that.
No.
As long as I had a plan to really do something. What my dad always said is, look, you have the brains to actually go to university and to make something out of your life. So I think you should use it. That is something that he did.
But
tell
also,
me.
You know, you and I come from a generation that were kind of the first women to go to university, or maybe second generation. I think the boomers may be the first, but Generation X. So I'm thinking, you know, there were a couple of things that were not so common. But then in the 80s and in the 90s, it was a little bit more common. I think it changed mid-90s to have studied different studies, because I did the same. I started out at university as well, studying.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And then I changed and went to, you know, a different school.
Yeah. So going back to that, so I did research for a year before jumping into the next best thing. And I then started business administration. That's the school we went to together. And it was international business administration. So it gave us the opportunity to spend half of our time abroad. And I went to Finland, which was amazing. And I still remember this story I told my boyfriend, now husband. So we've been together March 8, 32 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So.
And she's not very old, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you.
So she met him when she was 8.
Yeah. We were kindergarten.
Yeah, let's go younger.
Anyway. So. I told him, look, I found this amazing studies. And by the way, I'm going to Finland. And he said, oh, well, you know, also he didn't say, oh, what about us or whatever. We both were, you know, I wanted to do this. So he supported. And then he actually went to the US for his PhD, which would take him further away and longer even, but I supported him. But going to Finland, he said, oh, you have to be careful which direction the wind is blowing. And I go like, why? What a strange comment. And then he said, yeah, because, you know, it's not too far from Chernobyl. And I go, this is Finland I'm going to. What do you mean Chernobyl? And only then I looked at the map and I actually realized how far away it was.
Yeah. How close it was actually.
Well, how close and how far at the same time. And then I went there February 4th. I never forget that date. And it was minus 24 degrees. So it was an amazing experience. Really, really interesting. I did finish that in 4 years.
But that's because, don't you think we all finished it in those 4 years because we all went abroad as a group and we all wanted to have that same degree at the same time?
Yeah.
I will always remember our dinner at that hotel close to Central Station where we kind of celebrated how we all started and all finished. I think there might have been one or two people that didn't finish, but...
Yeah, and I think it also is... because of that and because I really loved what I was doing, you know, that international, because since then there was only 1 year in my whole career that I worked in a Dutch environment.
You've always worked in an international environment.
Always. And I think that has really given me so much more than just a career or friends or whatever, but really open up your eyes.
So the girl ended up going on the plane with the bag.
Exactly that, because after, I think it was in my second job that all of a sudden I was traveling with my briefcase in a plane full of businessmen. And I thought, oh my gosh.
I'm doing this.
And this is, you know, quite a long time ago already. Yeah. So it's amazing how things fall into place. And yeah.
If you follow your heart. And you're in sync. Yeah. You're absolutely doing that. So tell me, you're now a woman in tech. Mm-hmm. And what's actually your biggest responsibility right now? If you would have to explain it to me like I'm a 5-year-old girl.
So two things. And the first thing is really what I feel is the most important, and it's also what is closest to my heart. And it might sound tacky, but I really feel my most important responsibility is my people.
Yeah.
I have three teams reporting into me, and if I'm able to, and it's really interesting, somebody in the bigger tech organization used an analogy of being a shit umbrella. If I'm a good shit umbrella,
it doesn't go to for the people. My team. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you're protecting them against the shit.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it stops with you.
It stops with me. And then below the umbrella, I really feel that I have to help them be the best version of themselves. So I really believe that I'm good at building high-performing teams because I allow people to do what they love. So the same for me, you know, why did I end up where I am? Because I started doing something that
I love. What do you think you do differently from, you know, leaders that are not able to do this?
I would say two things. One is being empathic. I think I'm very empathic. Maybe sometimes too much. We had a conversation and there's a different word for when you're too empathic. But I think it's that. I can really relate to people, and also when they feel good, when they don't feel good, those types of things. And the other thing is I really believe I am that shit umbrella. And to use a different word, I really am a servant leader. I'm serving my team, whereas I still see a lot of colleagues of mine who are more traditional in their leadership style.
And it's funny that you're using that term, because that means that you actually went on the course to learn about what it means to be a servant leader. Because I was in a company the other day and the leaders didn't want to follow a course on what it means to be a different kind of leader, because they felt they were already in that position and they knew it already. Mm. Do you think being a servant leader means also keep working on yourself and your
own? Totally. So as you were giving this example, what I was also thinking, I said I have two things, but it's really many things combined in maybe that servant leadership. So one of the things that I always share with my team is continue to learn. I recently did a 6-month program at MIT.
MIT. As in Boston MIT.
Yes, as in Boston MIT.
Wow, that's quite impressive.
And before that, after the school you and I went to, I did my master's at Erasmus Universiteit. So it's something that I continuously do. If I have not learned something new, and it doesn't always have to be big, huh? But I really need to constantly learn to not get bored, mm-hmm. almost. So for me, that personal growth is super important. And what I also tell my teams is, okay, so you have to make sure that you constantly develop yourselves. And to do that, it's okay to make mistakes.
So what do they say to you? I mean, do you actually wait for them to come to you and say, I want to go on a course? Or are you the kind of leader that spots what they need and say, try this course? Or maybe it's a
bit
combination.
Of both. Yeah, it's a combination. So I have regular catch-ups with my people. And one of the things we talk about is personal growth. And so now the year-end conversations are coming. It's always a topic there, right? So it's looking back at what they did. But what I find much more interesting is looking forward. So what did you learn last year and how are you going to apply that? And what are you missing to get you there? And is it something that we can address by a training, or is it something that, for instance, one of the things, if people want to get a promotion, then I also always feel that to grow in a career, it's not only about being really, really good at what you do.
Yeah, we mistake
you
that, right?
Oh, exactly. There is a lot of other things that you need to grow in your career. And that's often related to visibility.
You know, I mean, it's our number one topic. It's
exactly
why we exist. Yeah.
Exactly. So that is something that we work on, and sometimes they bring it up.
Do you see that happening with women more, with people from a bicultural background more? That they're not really aware because they're so much focused on being good at their jobs?
I wouldn't dare say that. Now, the environment that I am in at PVH is relatively diverse.
Because it's an international...
It's an international fashion company.
And this is the head office, right?
And this is the head office. So here I see it with men, women, minorities. I think I see it more with it's not gender related as much, but it's more in character. There are people who are, I'm an extrovert. I'm always loud, you know, I'm always talking in rooms. And there are a lot of people who are not like that. And they don't want to be like that. They think it's terrible that I'm so loud, right? So it's also about them, and whether that's a man or a woman or a day or, you know, doesn't matter. It's really more about their character, I would say.
Okay, so if you're talking about the term servant leader,
yeah,
what excites you most about what you're currently doing as a servant leader?
Maybe I share an anecdote. I think it was last Wednesday. I hosted a New Year's drink at my house. And, you know, I invited my whole team. I specifically did not invite my peers who are together. We're in the leadership team of the tech department because I really wanted this to be for us or for them. And people were so appreciative of the fact that I invited them into my house, because I think it's personal, right? You have work mm-hmm. and you have your personal life. And this was inviting them into my private life, yeah. kind of. And people were so appreciative of that. And everybody was, you know, enjoying themselves, building relationships with each other, because I have these multiple teams that don't necessarily have to work together. And I love that, you know, those types of events or things really make me happy as a person and as a leader. And then, you know, I said a few words. I used my Star Wars lightsaber. I don't know if it's a story for here, but I can share definitely offline with you. But they also said a few words. And the key message that at least I remembered from it is that they really value the fact that I help them grow continuously, and that it's okay to make mistakes, that I encourage them to take more responsibilities, that I encourage them to look outside the box, to really go out and explore. And I think that is...
So yeah. That's about, you know, making sure that they all get the right opportunities. So why is that important to you, equal opportunities? Why is that an important topic to you?
Because I see that not everybody has equal opportunities.
So you see the privileges.
Totally, totally, yeah.
Can you give me a couple of examples of the privileges that you see?
First of all, myself being, and you and I talked about it maybe on several occasions already, I'm this white woman.
Cis woman.
Yeah, totally. I grew up in a loving family. I grew up in the Netherlands. Already just being born in the Netherlands makes me privileged. And on top of that, being a white person, there's nothing wrong with me physically. So, you know, that all, in a way, gives me a head start compared to other people who were born in a different situation with a different skin color, you know, those types of things. So being privileged is something that I see around me.
And how do you see it in the workplace? Because it's not 50-50 here at the top.
No, and that is interesting because as I mentioned before, working in a fashion company makes it rather diverse. But if you look at our leadership positions, then that diversity seems to stop somewhere. So even in the tech leadership team, we're seven, and there's two women.
And you're one of them.
And I'm one of them. In the executive leadership, it's a bit better, but if you look at below that, it's mainly men.
I must say that when you think about fashion, you don't really think about tech. So how do they, you know, even come together? I know that you grew a lot online. There's a lot of online buying that happens nowadays.
And yeah.
Is that where the tech part comes?
So, yes, definitely. So one thing, tech is in any company, right? Because nowadays you need, you know, your Wi-Fi, or you can't do anything if there is no tech. But what makes tech in the fashion industry so interesting, and there's, you know, women in the workforce, women in leadership, women in technology that I'm very passionate about. The other topic that I love is digital transformation in the fashion industry. So I also gave several guest lectures at University of Amsterdam about the topic, for instance, and it's exactly about that. So why is tech in the fashion industry so interesting? Because fashion is actually a really, really bad industry. You know, think child labor, think just, you know, all the water that is being used for denim, for the clothes, all the waste, you know, all the clothes that end up at this spot, we just burn, you know. So it's really terrible. The pesticides that we use to grow cotton, you know, all that. So it's a really, really bad industry. At the same time, I love fashion because it also is a means to express yourself.
To tell a story about who
you are. To tell a story about yourself, those types of things. And I really, really believe that with technology, we are changing the fashion industry
for
the good.
Better. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because, you know, all the initiatives that we have around sustainable production. To give you a specific example, until 10 years ago, maybe, the way it works is I'm a designer. I design a new product. I send that, thank goodness, through email or whatever, OneDrive. I share that with the factory in China, for instance. They make a first sample, then send it halfway across the world to me. Is this what you mean? You know what? That little button I want in a different position. I adjust my design, send it across again. They make another sample, send it across the world. And that happens 8-9 times. For
and tech made it possible thing. To make it quick,
absolutely.
To do it quicker.
We
yeah.
completely digitalized that whole design process.
So going back to, because I love the fact that you're explaining all of this, and you explained that you are talking to young girls, young women at the University of Amsterdam, but that you still have the challenge of being only 2 women out of 9 tech leaders here at this international huge company. How do we solve that problem?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what do you think your organization could be doing to get, is it getting you out there to talk more about women in tech, you know, to get more women as leaders in tech? Or is it the current women who are in the pipeline to go to the top? How do we make them see themselves as leaders in tech?
And it's hardly ever one answer, right?
Yeah.
It's usually a combination of many, many things.
But what are you doing? Let's keep it
small.
So
what I am doing is multiple things. One is I am speaking at conferences, I'm going to guest lecture, or I'm giving guest lectures and so on, just to bring awareness that tech
is interesting.
Is there in the fashion industry, and it is interesting.
Yeah.
It's not that nerdy thing mm-hmm. anymore. So that is what I personally am doing. The other thing I'm doing is that I'm working with the women in my organization to help them understand that they don't only have to be good at what they do, but to help them grow into senior positions, they also have to take care of that visibility part. So that's, for instance, where you and I also work together on their personal branding. And there's a lot more things that we're doing, but specifically, that's what I am doing. There is March 8th, International Women's Day. We're organizing an internal Women in Tech event. There's always a big conference in Rai, Amsterdam, Women in Tech. And typically, we go there. Someone is speaking, we have a booth, again, to really bring there, like, hey, we're out there, we do and great tech. And you know what? There's also a lot of women opportunities in there.
So I love the fact that you're talking about visibility. Visibility is also about not just, you know, making sure that your work gets noticed, because otherwise you won't get noticed, but also about what you think people should be seeing about yourself. You're a very extrovert person, like you said. Is there something that you're afraid to show in the workplace that you don't dare to show? Or can you see certain patterns of what women don't want to show in the workplace or don't want to talk about? But let's keep to yourself first.
If you would have asked me 10 years ago, my answer would probably have been different. One thing that I love about getting older is that I don't give a shit anymore.
Because you're 50 plus now.
Yeah. So yeah. I really don't care that much anymore what people think about me. So that is why, you know, is there something that I don't want people to see? Not really. I do realize that, for instance, you know, I talked about how, because I'm so extrovert, I'm always talking and I can be loud and not everybody likes that. So sometimes I realize, okay, this is really something that I should temper a bit, if that is even an English word.
But you don't want to make yourself too small.
Yeah. Then there is one thing, and it's maybe also an age thing. I think it's also because I'm so empathic. I'm a crier. I cry, you know, a lot. And there's
no crying in the workplace.
Yeah. No, exactly.
I mean, that's what we were taught, right?
Yeah.
You better not cry in your job.
So,
at your job.
But even with that, I don't mind so much if it's for good reasons. So what I mean by that is, luckily, I don't have it often that people leave my team. But whenever somebody leaves, most of the time when
you're
I
crying.
Address it, I'm crying, you know. And now it's become this joke, right? And then people say again, oh, there she goes again, you know. And we all have a big laugh about it. And it's cool. It's okay. So that I'm fine with now. But it also sometimes happens if I'm in a huge argument and I'm trying to make, and this has never happened in big meetings, but with my manager, and I'm so invested in a topic and I see that I'm not getting my point across, and then I started crying. That I absolutely hate, because I think it's the wrong moment to cry. It's really from bad emotions. But I also feel that it is a bit of an age thing with I've removed the word from my brain. I don't want to think not midlife crisis. What is it that women have when we're older?
Menopause.
Thank you. Because it makes me emotional.
Yeah,
and that is something that I really don't want to show in the
workplace. But should we talk about that more in the workplace?
Oh, totally.
Because nobody talks about it.
Nobody does. So what I'm,
you know, women are problems when they've got children. Then they're problems when they're becoming menopausal.
Yeah, we actually had, and I'm so proud of my company because we talked about this more frequently. I really believe that we are doing a lot about inclusivity and diversity, and it's not only that we talk about it or it's just some empty words in a strategy on a web page, but we really take action. And one of the things that we did is, in 22, actually the first time, is that we had a big event around menopause. And we had one of the events I went to was a panel discussion that we had, and we had somebody from the outside. She's the director of the Menopause Institute or whatever it's called. We had somebody, a lady from HR, and we had a man from the legal department, and they were talking about this and how this should become more normal in the world, because it is something that's happening. And, you know, we have all these rooms at PVH for young mothers to, I don't know what the word is in English, to call, you know, to get the milk for the baby ready in a bottle. We have spaces, we have mindfulness spaces, we have spaces where you can go to have a tough conversation. You know, it's the one that I showed you with the flowers inside and it smells nicely and things. So we do all these amazing things.
My whole team now is thinking, okay, we might come and work here.
And it is, it really is. But yeah, so I think it's super important that this is also a topic that is being recognized as reality, and it doesn't mean that that woman all of a sudden is no longer capable anymore of doing her job.
I know, but these are great things, and I'm really happy that you're doing them. And I also love
the food
that you've got here in the kitchen. It's very diverse, and it's, you know, and it looks very diverse as well. But we still have a problem at the top.
Yeah,
we still have you, another woman, and 7 other men.
Yeah.
So that's something, I mean, we spoke about privilege already, but there's still something that has to be over, you know, that we have to overcome to get to that place of 50-50 where it's 4 and 5 or 5 and 4. And something is keeping them.
Mm.
And it's 2023. So how do we get there?
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you bring this up. And we have an open vacancy for a VP position. And it's been super difficult to fill. And when I spoke to my peers recently about this, then actually they said, you know what? We're only going to interview women. Yeah. From now on. And
you've got to change the rules.
Exactly.
I mean, this is what I keep saying to companies. The current rules aren't working for women.
Yeah.
So unless you have the guts to change the rules and say and do something like what you just said, we're only going to interview women.
Yeah.
And then maybe take it even a step further and say 50% have to be women of color.
Yeah.
Then you force yourself to look differently at the problem, right? And look for different solutions and maybe in a different way that you've never done it before. And nobody called me, for instance.
Yeah. No, but exactly. I think that is the thing. So I think, you know, saying, okay, from now on, we're only going to interview women, that's a big step. But then, you know, also what you hear often is, but, you know, we can't find them. They're not there. But they are. So it's not only saying, okay, from now on, I'm only going to interview women, but it's also, how do you attract these women? So for instance, if I look at the way our job descriptions are written, it's terrible. It's so old school, it's not attractive. So maybe there is something there that would
doesn't
also
match what the women want.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I think it's really, in Dutch we have this word omdenken.
Yeah,
so it's really thinking differently.
Change your paradigm.
Exactly, yeah. It's really about that. So not continuing to do the same thing, but then looking at a different audience. No, but really completely changing the way
which is
you
what
do
you've
this.
Been doing, and I've been seeing you do this at this company. So, you know, we're almost coming to the end of my podcast, but there's a couple of questions left, and one of them is, where do you get the nerve? Where do you get the audacity to keep doing it the way that you're doing it? Because some women that I've spoken to over the last decade are afraid of losing their own jobs because they fought so hard to get there. And is that a privileged position to be in, where you're not afraid to lose your job and you just go for it? Like you said, you've registered, I think it was 12 women to go through my visibility program. You really invested in them and you talk to them even after the program. What do you think? How, you know, you talk to their managers, how you're really going out there and you're making yourself also seen on this topic, which, you know, is kind of risky.
Yes, and again, there's not one answer, but I think what is most important in this one maybe is, well, two. One is that age thing again, because I don't
care that much.
Yeah, exactly. I thought maybe I have to put it differently this time, but yeah.
No, it's
anyway,
my podcast.
So, but the other thing is, it's definitely a privilege thing, because I'm married to the guy who I met 31 years ago. He has quite a good job. So even if I would lose my job, we would still have a nice income. We do not have children. So I don't have to be afraid of, you know, I can't put my child through university or whatever. So it's definitely a privilege thing. Because if I lose my job, you know, then it would still remain the same. I think maybe some things would change. And also, I believe that the career I've had so far and the skills I have, they would land me another great job.
Because your skills are transferable.
Yeah.
So two questions. What advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
Don't give a fuck.
Okay, I like that one. Short and sweet. And what's your biggest ambition for the future?
Wow. For me or for the
future? For you.
For me, for the future. This is a bit of a longer answer. Because I hate it when people my age tell me, oh, I only have 222 weeks to go till my retirement. Something, I don't know what it adds up to, 222 weeks, but really working towards their retirement, because I love what I do. So for me, you know, that retirement age is not something that I work towards. What I work towards is that paying it forward is something that I really think is important, especially because I'm so privileged, but also because of all the learnings that I have. So I really envision myself, and my husband has the same, that we're in this position where we can mentor individuals and scale up, specifically in my case, where I have a group of enthusiasts who have this great product. They're growing really quickly, and then all of a sudden they have to start working with corporates or become more corporate themselves. They have to start thinking about HR, finance, those kinds of things. And I really believe that I can help them with that, but really from a good heart. You know, not so much because I have to make sure that I can afford food or something. My husband has been working in a completely different industry, always for startups in biotechnology. And he has always worked for startups, and he wants to do something similar, but then for startups. So how cool would that be, you know, that we can pay it forward, you know, and that all the learnings we have, and especially when it comes to diversity as well, where you help people, you know, put them in the spotlight if they don't dare to do it themselves, you know, or to just remind them every now and then to not give a shit, you know, to really help them take a step. Or what I always love is what is it? Ask for forgiveness. Do something and then ask for forgiveness later.
Don't ask permission, but ask for forgiveness later.
Well, that's something that I've been doing always.
It's very rock and roll. I learned that in the music industry.
Yeah, but it really, really helps. It gets stuff done, really. So I think that's super important.
Let's tell women to do that more. Don't ask for permission.
Absolutely.
If it gets you in trouble later, just ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Manana.
Same.
Yeah, definitely a rule breaker. And we're definitely excited about doing some more work together in the future, because I love this idea that you're doing.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.